This meeting is now being recorded.
Go right ahead, Justice Claire.
So welcome, everybody. I hope everyone is well. And as always, I thank you for taking some time to join us for this Language Access Call. In California, of course, all kinds of fashions and movies and trends come and go, but the work on language access continues. And today, we are going to do our best to take another step in our continuing effort to enhance access to the courts for California's many millions of limited English proficient residents and potential court users. So, as always, I'm grateful not only to the dedication of our task force members, but also to the Judicial Council staff and members of the public for your interest and dedication in the work, relative to the work we're doing. I want to remind everybody that today we are having an open meeting, so that means that you are being recorded. Please say your name before speaking so we can recognize you, and when you are not speaking or not inclined to speak, place your phone on mute so we can minimize background noise. And do not put us on hold because it may trigger music or pre-recorded messages, and I've had that happen before, and that's a problem. So also welcome to anybody who's from the public who's listening and joining us today. We appreciate your interest, and we have an important agenda. So we're just going to go ahead and start. So I'm now going to turn it over to Elizabeth, who's going to go through our roll call, and then I'll pick it up from there.
Thank you, Justice Claire. Judge Covarrubias.
I'm here.
Naomi Adelson. Judge Austin.
Here.
Kevin Baker. Angie Birchfield.
Here.
Justice Berniers.
Here.
Tracy Clark.
Here.
Judge Conklin.
Here.
Judge Court.
Here.
Judge Guard is not able to join us. Anna Maria Garcia. Susan Marie Gonzalez is not able to join us. Judge Hayashi.
Here.
Janet Hudak.
I'm present.
Joanne Lee.
Here.
Yvette Pena is not able to join us, and Justice Pena is not able to join us. Justice Renner.
Here.
Mike Roddy. Judge Rodriguez.
Here.
Janine Tucker.
Here.
Dr. Valdez is not able to join us. Jose Varela.
Yes, here.
Judge Walsh and David Yamasaki are not able to join us. Justice Zelon.
I'm here.
Did anyone else join during a roll call?
Yes, Elizabeth, this is Kevin Baker. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. And we have a quorum, Justice Square.
Oh, terrific. That's always great news. Okay. All right, so our first item of business is approval of minutes from our last meeting, which, as you may recall, was the very lively and informative community outreach meeting we held in April in Sacramento. You probably saw the draft minutes in the meeting materials that were sent out last week. And do we have a motion to approve the minutes from April 24th?
So moved. This is Terry Berniers.
Thank you, Justice Berniers. Do we have a second?
Second, Judge Conklin.
Thank you, Judge Conklin. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Okay. Any aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give you a quick update on what's happening with language access policy from the task force leadership perspective, and then we are going to go to a consideration of proposed rule 1.300, where we have a revised draft. So before I go to Rule 1.300, what I wanted to do was to give you a sense of all that's been going on since we held our last meeting. We have since then been working very closely with Judicial Council staff to complete as many of the LAP recommendations as possible. I've always tried to emphasize in these calls just how precious every single day and week and month is for the task force. To date, we've completed 36 of the 75 recommendations. As you know, not all recommendations are created equal. They're all important, but some are very, very big, like expand access to interpreters in civil proceedings. Some are more technical. but I'm very happy we've gotten 36 of them pretty much completely done. We have continuing work on 27 additional ones, and there are about 12 recommendations that are either more long-term or going to just require ongoing effort from the branch and will run beyond the life of the task force. In November, next month, I'm going to give an update to the Judicial Council on all the progress that the task force has made in about 3.5 years, thanks to the help and dedication of people on this call. I am in touch with Judge Covarrubias, who's playing a particularly important role in his capacity as vice chair. And what he's doing is he's chairing a working group on the long-term LAP recommendations that are likely to require lots of our dedication as a branch beyond the life of the task force. So I'm going to be checking in with him in the next couple of weeks to make sure that we're on track, to make sure those recommendations get the attention they deserve, and to prepare them for staff to continue to work on and or to transfer them to a successor body of some kind. As you know, the task force is going to wind up its official work in March of 2019. What is happening right now in the background is I've been continuing my conversations with the Chief Justice, with Martin Hoshino, and with others on how to continue the work of the task force. It's clear to me that the task force had a special opportunity to really forge ahead on a bunch of things that really required attention and a lot of support, like expansion of access to interpreters in civil proceedings, but it's also clear to me that some of the work is going to have to continue beyond the life of the task force, so I'll have more updates on that as we proceed. In the meantime, between now and March of 2019, I'm going to be working closely with the Executive Office and with the Chief Justice to make sure that all the things that we're doing in the task force can proceed as intensely and as quickly and in as well-supported a way as possible. And I'll go back to resources in a moment. Now that we are kind of at the culmination of the task force's work, where we have about 4.5 months left, I want to highlight some of the things that we have done that are most significant and that continue to be very much on the top of my agenda. So that includes the video remote interpreting pilot project, funding requests to ensure that there are enough funds for full civil expansion, and data collection and monitoring. Let me just say a little bit more about each one of those, and then I'll turn it over to Justice Zilon and Judge Rodriguez. So it was kind of a heavy lift to get the VRI pilot project going. We did a lot of consultation. We tried to get it right. We didn't want to go too fast, too quickly. So the actual testing concluded on July 31st, 2018. We did this in Merced, in Sacramento, and in Ventura County. Right now, San Diego State University is working on the final evaluation report. The IT staff of the Judicial Council is working on minimum technical guidelines, kind of taking advantage of what we learned in this project, that might be useful as we think about what next steps are feasible to do. They're going to be working closely with the National Center for State Courts on that. And then we hope that in December there will be a VRI work stream meeting to look at the draft Judicial Council VRI report that's going to be generated by San Diego State and to think about next steps. We will then need the task force and ITAC to approve the VRI report and attachments in January 2019 before we send that report to the council. On court interpreter reimbursement, as you probably have been following, a number of you, and at the September 21st business meeting, the council approved an allocation of $3.4 million from the trial court trust fund. This was a one-time allocation, and it was meant to cover any shortfall in the court interpreter reimbursement fund in the current fiscal year. Now, obviously, this was really important because we didn't want to face a situation where just at the moment where we're finally succeeding in getting so many trial courts to do this expansion, that they might worry that there will not be enough resources. So obviously now we are working with staff, as you might expect, to make sure that we do everything possible to get a BCP approved for FY 2019-2020 that is going to help us a great deal. So the bulk of the request that we made is for expansion, augmentation of the court interpreter reimbursement fund. We requested $12.6 million in 2019-2020 and an ongoing $14.1 million for 2020-2021. All of this is to say that to me the fact that we are having to request this money is a sign of success in a way. It means people are actually doing the expansion, and as you might expect, the expansion does take additional resources. I want to mention also that there has been a lot of activity around small claims and language access. You might have seen that during the summer there was discussion of a bill, SB 1155, which the California courts initially supported to try to improve access to interpreters in small claims proceedings. There were some amendments that raised some concerns, but in the end, the bill was enacted by the legislature, signed by the governor last month, and it becomes effective on January 1st of 2019. So despite past reservations, my view is our responsibility now is to help implement it as effectively as possible, taking into account concerns from anybody who has them, and we're going to be working on that in the next few months. Last but certainly not least, I would say it's important to note that from the very beginning in the work of the task force, data has been crucial. We can't tell a story about what people need without data. We can't tell who needs what without data. So we do have some positive aspects of what the data tell us right now, including that 51 out of 58 responding courts indicate that they are able to provide interpreters in all 8 civil priorities. That's why we need the extra money. But we, most of you know that we don't have the data infrastructure that we fully need, so we're working on that. We are benefiting from the fact that our staff now has a dedicated data person, and my hope is that a memo that will be issued by staff working with the leadership of the task force in very shortly is going to be a real turning point, because it will set the foundation for gathering better data about interpreter use, about concerns that are being raised at the local level, about what the trial courts are doing in different counties, and that's going to help us actually know that this is all working very, very long term. So as the end of the official cycle of the task force in March approaches, I'm quite confident that our subcommittee chairs are going to work closely with all the subcommittees and staff to finish as many projects as we can. And I'm going to be working with Judge Covarrubias to make sure that these longer-term issues get the attention they deserve. So stay tuned. There's more to do and more to say. In January, the task force is going to meet with the subcommittee chairs, and we hope to send the VRI package to the council, so we'll be in touch about task force action on that. And now I want to take a pause and turn it over to Justice Zilon and Judge Rodriguez to talk about another one of our priorities, which is Rule 1.300.
Thank you, Justice Cuellar. This is Justice Zilon. I hope that you've had that everyone's had a chance to look at the materials on this Rule 1300. As you recall, we discussed this some time ago when we brought an initial draft from the committee. There were some issues that were raised after the draft, some of them by the committee, some of them by others. And since that time, we have been working, and Judge Rodriguez has been an enormous actor in this, and I cannot thank him enough. We have been working with the CEOs and with the PJs to talk about issues that concern them, issues of burden on the court, issues of time to get this done, issues of cost. The most extensive discussions were with the Los Angeles Superior Court, and Yvette Pena worked very hard with us to communicate the concerns that that court had and to work with us on finding ways to address them. So the draft you see in front of you now is based on all of the conversations that we had with all of those various people, and is an attempt to keep a strong rule that makes sure that people are not ordered to participate in services which they can't meaningfully participate in because there are no language services available, but also allows the trial courts to manage the implementation of this in a way that works for them, that gives them enough time to train people, to put processes in place. There are some forms that were adopted that are, prepared that were attached to the draft of the rule that are intended to assist both the court and the litigants in working through this process. And it is our hope at this point that the committee will approve this to go out to RuPro and to be approved for circulation and ultimately to the Judicial Council for approval. We have worked in particular with the Advisory Committee on Providing Access and Fairness because they have such a strong interest in many of the issues that this rule addresses. They saw an earlier draft, and we also would like to go back to them one more time if this committee approves the draft to see if they have any further comments before we go out for formal comment period. Our hope was to address most of the comments, potential comments prior to the comment period so that this could be a relatively seamless process going forward. Judge Rodriguez, do you want to add anything?
I just want to add some words of thanks to the staff, Deanna Glick, who helped us with this, Justice Salen for all of her leadership on this, and Yvette in particular, who was very helpful, as Justice Salen was saying, in terms of giving us some insight, particularly for counties that are particularly large and on which this would be some burden, to figure out some language. And I'll just add on a personal note that I started working on Rule 1.300 when I was working for Justice Cuellar. I've since taken the bench in Alameda County, and in that role, send lots of people to court order programs, and lots of people that in Alameda County have language access services. And I think that although I have a new appreciation for the nuances and intricacies that this rule can impose on courts, I also have a newfound appreciation for the urgency for which this rule is necessary, so that we aren't sending people who have language access needs to court-ordered programs that they absolutely cannot access because they're not available in those language access, in those languages that they need.
Thank you, Justice Elon and Judge Rodriguez. I want to take a moment to see if anybody has any brief questions they'd like to ask the justice or the judge.
This is Janet Hudick. If I can ask a question.
Sure, please go ahead.
First of all, I want to thank you for the wonderful work that you guys did with the Rule 1.300. But I do have a question regarding A2, where it's the word or the phrase is court litigant. I was kind of comparing to the prior draft that we had. I was just wondering if court litigant or just the word litigant would encumber everything. I mean, if a layman were supposed to read it, would that also imply in criminal? I don't know if I made any sense.
Well, this would apply to criminal because people are ordered to programs in criminal cases. And they have a need to understand those programs. And one of the issues that can arise is in a domestic violence case, for example, where someone is ordered to a violence prevention program or a parenting program as a condition of probation. And they cannot fulfill the condition of probation if they are ordered to a program that is not available to them in their language or when there are no language services provided to them with the program. So it's very important that it covers everyone.
Well, I was just kind of wondering why the word litigant and not court user like we had in previous in the previous draft.
That was something that I believe was suggested by Los Angeles as something that would be helpful to them.
Okay. And I remember a little bit of the discussion, and it's a good question. What I recall is there was a concern that maybe court user might apply to a very large chunk of the public that in some sense are using the courts, and so they wanted to make sure the focus was placed on people who were parties in a court case. But I would take this comment under advisement as something we might look at in terms of the commentary to add to make sure that it's sort of clear that it applies to criminal, for example.
Right. It's just that the word litigant, to me, it means civil lawsuit or
gotcha.
Anything. I was just kind of wondering what the thought process was with that. And if anything, using the word litigant would actually discourage people from in criminal or would bar them from actually having these services in the programs that are mandated.
So this moves forward. I'm happy to have Justice Elon and Justice Rodriguez kind of take a look at how we can clarify to make sure that people understand this applies to criminal.
And just so I did see the comment, which is mm-hmm. in subdivision C in the comment section, that it does, you know, also refer to, I believe it's Subdivision D.
Subdivision D talks about battery intervention.
Yeah.
Right. But I was just wondering if a lot of people just read the rule and don't go into the comments, if mm-hmm. using the word litigant would kind of just sway them from thinking that this encumbers everything. And I understand what you guys are trying to accomplish, and I think you guys did an excellent job. I'm just kind of, I don't know about litigant, but then again, I'm not an attorney. It can be a term of art. So I was just asking.
Okay. Well, my suggestion is that we take this as something that can be considered in the comment process. I would say if there are other ways that people whom we've been working with would feel comfortable with that still conveys that we're talking about parties to some kind of court proceeding, we can try to find a way to work that in.
Hello, I'm sorry.
This is Judge Covarrubias.
Okay.
Yep.
Sorry. Yep, sorry. This is Bob. The definition of court litigant in the rule, it is defined as a person who is a party in a court case or other legal proceeding. So even though perhaps the word choice itself may not be ideal, the definition does seem to include and encompass all proceedings in a trial court, civil and criminal.
Thank you, Bob. Judge Covarrubias.
I just had a question, particularly to the criminal side of cases where you have a charge of domestic violence, someone is placed on probation, and it's mandated under the code that they participate in a 52-week session of domestic violence counseling, and possibly also, if a child endangerment charges, child abuse prevention counseling. And I'm just wondering if there's any thought given as to how this would apply when you don't have someone with language services and there's no provision under the code that allows some deviation from the court ordering or mandating it, and how that would, what the interplay would be, and whether or not we're going to need to make some changes there if that would be something to be required.
Judge Covarrubias, that's a really important issue, and that is the primary reason for the comment in subdivision for subdivision D. The application of the good cause standard, and if you look at the forms also provide an outlet where you can seek delay or a different order that serves the same purpose if the language services are not available. I do think that one of the issues that this whole area raises is the courts being aware of lack of resources in the community, which is one of the reasons that we're encouraging courts to kind of set up a database so they know what's out there. It may be that at some point there is a legislative change necessary. If there is pushback on this finding of good cause that's suggested in subdivision D, but it seemed in all of the discussions that that was the most appropriate way to handle mandatory programs.
Thank you.
This is Naomi Adelson. I have a question right about that. So if the judge, if the language is not available and then the judge does not delay or does not find good cause, does this just allow that defendant to be punished anyways?
Well, I think that may raise an appellate question.
Yeah,
okay,
just to follow up on that briefly, it was an issue that we couldn't fully resolve in these rules because we needed to work on making them consistent with the statutes.
Right.
Okay, and then I just had one more comment just in the definition.
Sure.
The following thing says that language services are services designed and may include, and then it says interpreters, but I think we want to say that it may include interpretation, and that interpretation would be in-person, telephonic, or VRI. Because interpreters are not a service, but interpretation is.
Oh, okay.
And
Chapter 3 in A3?
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
And so, and it could just be shortened to say mm-hmm. it might include I would say qualified interpretation, be it in-person, telephonic, or VRI. And that's where my question is. Now we're talking about court-provided services that are not court proceedings. And we've come all the way from qualified interpreters. Now we're down to having bilingual volunteers. So I don't know. Is there any guarantees for people to get qualified interpreters or qualified language services, meaningful language access? And I'm sure the court doesn't have a way to ensure that because, well, in this they do. This, if it's a court-provided program, shouldn't it have to provide qualified and meaningful language access?
Well, these are not in-court proceedings. In the sense of hearings or trials.
Right. It's just court provided.
Well, this rule covers both court provided and outside provided services. And the intent is to ensure that people can have access to the programs.
I understand. I think my issue is I wish they could have access to the programs and have meaningful interpretation or meaningful language access to those programs, and that we don't just – a bilingual volunteer who is put in a position of interpreting those programs concerns me.
Understood.
Yeah. I don't know if they have a way around it.
And let us take another look, but I will say that the more restrictive you make the ability to provide the services, the more difficult it is for trial courts to comply.
Exactly, yes.
But it's a fair concern, and we take it under advisement. Any other questions or comments at this point? Let me make an observation then. I do think some of the comments that have been raised really highlight something important about this rule, which is we don't view it as the end of a process. We view it as a beginning in the following sense. It is incredibly urgent and important to us as a task force, I believe at least, to put a stake in the ground and begin to establish what it is that is really at stake when people are ordered to complete a program that they simply cannot because of a language barrier. Now, some of that journey we can go on with this rule. I think it's a tremendous move in the right direction. But the really, really, really complex negotiation that has played out to get to this point, and I do want to just emphasize that Justice Zeilan and Judge Rodriguez and Yvette and others in not only the LA courts but others, we've really had to work hard to kind of find enough common ground where, on the one hand, those of us who want not only language access but and not only meaningful language access but really top-notch language access have to find common ground at this point with the ones who are kind of most leery of this and most concerned about how is this going to be implemented, what is it going to mean. And I would not want to move forward with that process if I didn't think it was a very meaningful step forward. But that doesn't mean that there aren't really important things that will have to be kept an eye on if this rule is enacted in this form, and I hope it is in some form like this, to make sure that it's implemented in a way that is meaningful. And I certainly would like to use whatever opportunity I have when doing my best to present this rule and what it represents to highlight what the intent behind it really is. So I also want to remind folks that although we've tried to do as much work as we can on the front end to limit the risk to this basic framework from the public comment process, that comment process is meaningful, and what we're voting on today, if the task force is willing to move forward, is to put this out for public comment. So there will be no doubt further steps on this journey, but what we have tried to avoid is a situation where we can never get to the point of actually finalizing the rule because there's always a more perfect rule that we can imagine. So I think people probably understand that, but I wanted to make that as clear as I could. So with that, I wonder if anybody has a motion to have the task force approve the draft proposal with the tweak that was mentioned in changing interpreters to interpretation in A3. And that would allow it to move out to public comment and to submit it eventually for presentation to the advisory committee on providing access and fairness, and eventually to RuPro.
This is Dennis Hayashi. I'll move approval.
Thank you, Judge Hayashi. Is there a second?
Judge Conklin, second.
Thank you, Judge Conklin. Any further discussion? Okay. Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you, everybody. So this is approved, but we will move it along, and we can assure you that we will keep you posted on further developments, but I do want to emphasize how much I'm grateful to our staff, and especially for their leadership, to Justice Zilon and Judge Rodriguez. I want to make a... Thank you. Thank you. I want to make two comments in closing, if I could. The first one is about how hard I hope that everybody on this call will be willing to work in the next 4.5 months. I am currently quite confident that we're going to have a good outcome for a successor entity that will carry the language access work on to the next stage, but that's still being worked on. In the meantime, whatever form that successor process takes, I am also quite certain that we need to leverage the time that we have to lay a stable foundation for the future. And I think that is going to take a lot of determination and effort. We will be enlisting you in all kinds of ways, and we will stay as close as we can to all of you. Second, I just want to take a moment to recognize one of our members, Justice Terry Braniers, for his service not only to the task force but to the California judiciary. He is retiring shortly, and this is probably going to be his last task force call, so we're grateful for his service, for all his efforts and his sleepless nights to get the VRI pilot project off the ground. Thank you, and we are glad he's been able to be such a pivotal player in the work of the task force. So thank you, Justice Braniers.
Thank you very much.
We will miss you, and we will remember you often, not only when we're talking about VRI, but in other occasions as well. And with that, let me thank everybody, and onwards on language access.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you, and goodbye.